there's a lot of value in relationships which is untapped. Relationship isn't between the sales force and that and the client. Relationship is every single individual in a business and how it behaves every time I touch them. So if I ring the finance department, I want the same values and behaviors and intent towards the client as I would get from a salesperson. The relationship must not sit within individuals. As we have previously done, you know, we have paid major account sales guys huge amounts of money because we were frightened that without them we'd lose the relationship. What we're suggesting is relationships are holistic between organizations, and actually the best relationships are when they come together with a shared ambition.
So, welcome to another episode of Old Fox, Young Fox. I'm here with Jeremy. Of course. How are you, Jeremy?
Hi, I'm very well, thanks, Ollie. Strange not having you in the same room, though, I have to say.
Do you miss me?
Not at all. No, this is great.
Perhaps I shouldn't take the compliments. So, what are we going to talk about today, my friend?
Well, today, really, we're going to start a conversation about how we can be thinking about organizations, creating organizations fit for the 21st century. I mean, it's something that we've touched on many times before. The idea that the old model probably isn't appropriate going forward, and we need to find other ways of operating. And certainly with the corona crisis, it's sort of forcing organizations to operate differently. And so within that context, it's really quite helpful to have a conversation now. And to help us with this, we've got an old acquaintance of mine, Kevin Vaughan Smith. And Kevin is the joint managing director of an organization called Mutual Value and has particular ideas about how you can create relationships with partner organizations and so on, which are much more positive, where you're releasing the real human potential of organizations to maximize the opportunity, maximize the potential of relationships, and make business more effective. I don't know if that's a reasonable summary, Kevin, of what you do. But perhaps, well, first of all, welcome and thanks for joining us. But maybe you'd like to just introduce yourself and talk a little bit about what you do within Mutual Value.
Hi, Oliver. Hi, Jeremy. It's really good to be here with you, well, virtually here with you this afternoon. What does Mutual Value do? I think you summed it up pretty well. Our experience is that the previous ways that people have worked have been highly transactional, by which I mean there's us, the seller, and them, the buyer. And we've fallen into this habit of thinking it's win and lose and defense and attack. And, you know, if I lose this time, I'll get you next time. And all of that worked okay. It resulted in some pretty interesting things like massive procurement exercises, which typically didn't produce what either side wanted. And it also produced a lot of dissatisfaction downstream from the people trying to deliver things. So having spent 20 years in IT on major project sales, and then the last 20 years trying to convince people not to do it that way, Mutual Value is the summary of that thinking. And it's what it's saying is, if we can step back from the initial transaction and start thinking more broadly about what is it that we're trying to do in the marketplace, and who have we got who could possibly benefit and partner with us in that marketplace, we step back, as I say, and we come up with a co-created vision of potential. And we commit jointly with our partners to that vision. And then we also work out how we're going to behave together and how we will be paid or draw rewards from that relationship. And it's by having those mutual value relationships where you step back from the transaction and focus on the relationship itself that you transform not only the way that the ambition you can have together, but the way you behave and the results you achieve. So that's really why I'm so excited about mutual value thinking. Other people have described it as ecosystem thinking, eco-leadership. Most of that tends towards process. We look very heavily at the behaviors because it's what people do, not the bits of paper you write down that make the difference.
Why do you think we've got to a state where we actually need to do this? Because it's traditionally a relationship between organisations would involve a sort of mutual benefit and win-win type situations. Why have we got to a state where we need to suddenly create new mechanisms for reintroducing that way of thinking or that way of being?
Well, you see, you said something there that I'd have to challenge. I don't think many people are into win-win. I think they dress up partnership. I was talking to a gentleman yesterday who's part of a very large civil engineering business, and he was saying, yeah, we've talked about this partnership stuff, specifically with government, for years, but actually what they're interested in doing is transferring risk to us at the lowest possible price. And that really isn't a partnership. That's a risk management exercise. If you think about it, or when I think about it, if you look at the number of projects for civil engineering, for IT, for professional services, all of which I've been involved in, you look at the number of projects which actually deliver what either side wants. The one hand is a result, the other is some kind of profit reward. They don't work. And I don't think it's possible for us to really go on that way. And many people, like the government, indeed, have said, this can't keep happening. And if you're a civil engineering firm, one of the things that shocked me, across the top 150 civil engineering firms in this country, the average margin before COVID, well, you might be shocked, but it was 2% and less. So these firms are taking huge risk. They're managing enormous projects on our behalf, building bridges, hospitals, roads, you name it, the Network Rail, HS2, all these things. And they're doing it to make less money than they could make by putting it in the bank.
Amazing. But I have definitely seen it in Australia and New Zealand and here. I've seen the largest construction firms just go belly up. And he's suggesting that kind of margin could be improved on with this kind of thinking.
So that's the point, isn't it? I mean, you need one major project to go wrong and your whole business can go bust. I mean, look at Carillion. If you want a vivid example, look at Carillion. Now, the interesting thing about Carillion was that not only did you have lack of partnering between the government and Carillion as the major contractor, but the other way of thinking about this is the contractor with their supply chain. That is another area where there's a lack of mutual value, which is why when Carillion went bust, actually the major damage was done in the supply chain. All the small businesses who weren't being paid, who were being strung along, and were doing great work building hospitals and whatever, but were being manipulated horribly. And that kind of behavior cannot be the right way forward, either in the government sector or in major IT services or professional services. So more and more people recognize it, and we're thrilled about that.
Certainly my experience in construction was that it was adversarial and very heavy into litigation. And it was a very toxic sort of environment. How is it that it survived so long that way? I mean, there must be something in it that works for these organisations, or they wouldn't have...
Well, there used to be, but things have changed quite a bit. At one time, if the government let a major project, they would put down a huge amount, a significant proportion of that project in terms of cash up front. And then they would fight about what they got for their money. And not only that, but a lot of the major contractors would not pay their subcontractors very quickly. So these were hugely cash-rich businesses, which allowed their owners, PE houses or whatever, to use that cash for all sorts of good things. What's changed, at least in this country, is the government no longer pays cash up front. They pay cash throughout the process. And there's legislation which says you have to pay your subs. So that model has changed dramatically, which means that investors are not looking at this as being a sector that they want to get involved in at a high risk basis. So yeah, things have changed dramatically. But the other thing is, I think that human nature has changed. People are not wage slaves. We don't want to turn up and do stuff which doesn't make sense and isn't the right thing to do, but we're doing it just because it was in the RFP or the tender process. People have got knowledge and they want to share that and want to see it rewarded. And this is, to my mind, mutual value is about engaging and exciting people about what they're doing.
I think that's all great. One of the questions I would have is, to a degree, this notion about wage slaves. I think my experience is that an awful lot of organizations don't treat their staff terribly well. And the whole thing has become a very transactional relationship in itself. So it's not just a transactional relationship with your partner organizations. It's also a transactional relationship with staff. People don't tend to stay so long. It's that the degrees of loyalty on both sides have been eroded. How do you see that being affected by your notion of mutual value?
Well, again, it's really interesting. The point about mutual value is it's a focus on a relationship, but it's not a relationship between an account manager and their client. Mutual value engages the business in the sense of, we term it relationship capital. This is where every part of a business touches every part of its client. And you need to think about, how will you engage everybody in doing that role? And there's a lot of excitement for people in saying, what we're going to do is, we're not going to transact. We're going to step back and say, how does our organization, and that's you, by the way, it's the people that are the organization, how does our organization create value in a market? And if we come together with this client, how can we actually take it to 333? The point being that it's what you're going to do that's going to help us achieve those ambitious visions. But it's a co-creation internally first and then externally second, which means that the likelihood is that people will be engaged at a much higher level than when they are distanced from the whole thing. So this is a holistic cultural change, not just a fancy way to sell things to people.
I've seen some really interesting examples of this in, you imagine, the town hall, you've got the whole business gathered together, folks are hearing what's happening with this client, how are we helping them, where are we going? And often the people who put their hand up are not the people I would have expected, meaning they're actually finance or admin staff who are super passionate. I can think of one woman in particular, and she just really wants to get involved. My first thought was, she needs to be in marketing or she needs to be in sales. But perhaps there's some merit in what you're saying, that actually people want to be connected to the outcome.
Yeah, I think that's a great example. I mean, I think, and I'll step back from it just for a moment and come back to it. My point is, the first great relationships you need to create, the first mutual value relationship you need to create, are internal. If you think about your great example of finance, who wanted to participate, well, even before that, if go back to the day when the CEO or somebody stood up and said, hey guys, this is the strategy going forward, we're going for growth or we're going for whatever we're going for, then all of the people in that room, finance, marketing, sales, ops, IT, probably went away and said, okay, well, what are we going to do? But they did it at best on their own. Or they probably went, well, that's good for them, but we're busy doing the IT strategy. Or that's good for them, but I've got HR to run. They didn't really connect with it. And what that means is, we get conflict all across organizations unnecessarily because they're not working to a shared sense of value or relationship. So the first step is to get people to understand, this is the strategy, this is the vision. The next step is to say, how are we all going to collaboratively deliver on that? And then the third, so that's that internal thinking. Then the third step is to go out to the market and say, who could we best work with that would deliver our vision and their vision so that we can come up with a co-created mutual value relationship for both sides, but it starts internally and then it goes outside. Because if you try and project externally something which is not true internally, you're lying, putting it bluntly.
And how do you go through that process?
Goodness. Great question. That's always what people say when they want to think, right? But even so, it is a good question. The first step is you've got to work with a senior leadership team to help them understand what's the potential value for us undertaking this process. And, you know, I mentioned sort of work we're doing in the civil engineering space, where they are seeing if we carry on like this, we're at risk. So the first thing is to work with them. Go on.
I was just going to say, so most of the clients that you mix with, they have a real sense of where they're positioned in the minds of their client base. They know they've got a problem and they want to do something about it.
Most of them know that the status quo is not going to be sufficient for the future. Yeah. Now, they don't know what to do about it, but they do know that the current situation is problematic.
And generally, how aware are they? Sorry, I'm not sure if you're hearing me. I'm getting all sorts of strange things happening with my mic. Can you hear me all right, Ollie?
Your mic is cutting out.
You're getting the feedback.
Yeah. Okay.
You're muting yourself, aren't you, Jeremy?
Well, when it's on, I can hear myself talking as well, which is a bit disconcerting. Am I supposed to be able to do that? So if I'm hearing myself answer the question.
No, you shouldn't hear that.
Yeah.
So it might just be that something funny has happened and in the setup. But if you can tolerate it, then
I will see. It's a bit disconcerting, but I'll carry on. I think, okay, I'll start again. I get involved with Independent Perspective in terms of stakeholder audits, where we go and look at organization perceptions around the perceptions of their stakeholders. And we do a sort of mismatch analysis and all this sort of stuff. And one of the things that always surprises me is how little organizations understand. There's a very lack of awareness about what their clients really think of them within the organization. And there's very little consistency between people within an organization as to what those perceptions might be. So there's a huge mismatch all the way around. And that's the first thing that I think needs to be tackled. Because otherwise you go into the organization, you have these conversations, but if it's without the input of what external groups are thinking, it's rather misleading. And people can be sort of very misled by all of this stuff.
I would agree. I think people need to do more customer sensing than they actually do. I've got some colleagues who work with a really interesting way of doing that called Big Ears, where they're actually giving people the opportunity to leave spoken feedback, which is much more powerful, and then using clever software to analyze the spoken feedback and to actually just prepare it and present it to the board. But you're right, this is all about building a picture of what the clients think. Our experience is, though, even if you've got a picture and you build a vision of what you want to do, people are not very good at sharing that story with the client and then getting commitment from clients to move forward. And that's one of the interesting things, is people love to do things in isolation. As you say, they don't ask the client what the client thinks of them, and then they come up with a strategy which is supposed to delight the client, but they don't ask the client what they think. All of these things, this new level of communication, I think, are required to move away from transactional thinking.
Very good. So you would do you'd go into client organizations and you'd talk to a cross section of your clients, or how does that work?
So our advice, I've got an ideal. The ideal is the client. We do stakeholder, probably similar sort of ideas to yourself, and we can talk further about that. We do stakeholder analysis, but then we'll ask for permission to go and speak to a number of clients, key clients, to get client feedback directly. And then we'll match and merge and come up with a vision with the client. The first stage is clarity. We have these three stages we go through. Building clarity about who it is you're trying to serve and how you're trying to serve them and what the value is you believe you create in that market based on that stakeholder and client mapping. Once they've got that strong narrative at the leadership level, we then talk about, so what are the behaviors that you're going to want to show and how will that intent to build a relationship show itself? That's the character side. And then the third element that we work on is, and so what are the capabilities that you're going to bring to those clients that will deliver on the vision that you have, that will be aligned behind the behaviors that you've said are important to you? And when you've got those three things, clarity based on feedback and assessment, a character side, which is about how you'll behave, and capabilities, which are the values you'll create in the market, then you've got an opportunity to build trust with your clients and value.
So, Ollie, what's your experience of this? Is this sort of thinking permeating the organizations you're familiar with?
It's an interesting question. I think that I've seen a wide range of organizational cultures. And as Kevin's talking, I'm thinking about different scenarios where strategy has been shared internally and we've taken it out to market and it has worked or it has not worked. And I'm thinking about situations where I'm involved in the pitch, the onboarding, and then the servicing. And I talk to people internally who are doing the servicing of the client, and what they are talking about completely misses the original point. So I think a lot of that rings true for me in terms of needing to have a thread and intention in terms of why are we engaging and what value are we bringing, and being really clear on that. I've definitely seen it cause problems, and I've definitely seen it waste a lot of cycles. And often when I've talked to people internally in different roles and said, we need to do something about this, we need to get everybody on the same page, we'd often lean towards well, let's get XYZ involved in the sales process so that they're connected to what's being sold all the way through. But I'm now realizing that that's probably not enough.
I think it's a very interesting observation. And what you're pointing to is the divergence. You know, I mentioned this earlier, because we haven't joined up the internal parts of the business, it shows up in our client. So great example I saw recently was an engineering business who answered an RFP. And I said, well, how do you go about answering the RFP? And they said, well, we gave them a very rosy picture, frankly, but that's what they were asking for. But we reckoned we'd work out after the fact what they really needed. So now you've got sales, the sales team, selling a promise. And they needed to sell a promise they felt to win and to meet their metrics. Then the operations and delivery team had gone in, and they'd basically been faced with managing this whole mismatch between reality and the promise. But worse than that, they were also operating to a set of metrics which were not aligned with those of the sales force. So they're trying to, this was a juggling act and a half, and the stress and tension between operations and sales was huge. And in the middle of that was the poor customer saying, well, I'm not even sure you're doing what I want you to do. Of course, it was worse than that, because the customer was saying, I'm not sure that our procurement team really understood what we want to do, so we need you to flex from what you was started. It just becomes a mess because we have no shared ambition. I don't know if that resonated with you.
Yeah, it did. And that shared ambition, I guess what I'm also thinking about is that shared ambition is also often not shared on the customer side and their team. And I think, you know, in a world full of partners, and the partner organization even more, because we're actually going to market together. And often what I'm finding is that a project, if it lasts long enough, may outlast some of the original stakeholders. And there doesn't seem to be an understanding amongst all the parties concerned that it's important to stay on message, on value, remembering why we're here. So do you also see that responsibility being shared by the customer and by the partners?
Absolutely. Ideally, what you're trying to do is to create an ecosystem with the client. So you start by saying to the client, well, this is what we can produce and this is how we could do it for you. But ideally, we'd love to step back from that and say, if we worked collaboratively, what could we do that's better than we're imagining at the moment? And it's about creating that overall picture, and that's the thing that keeps everything else straight. Because within the big picture, this is our overall ambition, then we'll do transactions, we'll do some kind of project for you, we'll have some kind of change going on. All sorts of things can come in, but the thing that has to stay as the guardian is this overall relationship agreement, this ambition that we share, these behaviors that we've agreed to. That has to stay as the guardian to the rest of it.
And how do you hold people accountable to that agreement?
So as part of the relationship development process, and we have a series of tools and processes for this, but as part of it, you describe the ambition, you describe the resources and the capabilities that you'll bring to the ambition, both sides. This is not what I'm going to do for you. This is what we are going to do to achieve this shared ambition. So we've got an ambition that we share. We've got resource agreements. We've got rewards in there. So it's, this is how the outcomes for you. This is the outcomes for us, margin, revenue, whatever it is. Because part of what the buyer might bring is the money. And then you also talk about, so these are the behaviors that we will exhibit in this process together. And we want to spend a lot of time defining the values and behaviors to a depth where everybody can communicate them clearly and consistently. And then we go to accountability. So how are we going to measure each other? How often, in what ways? And many of those will be behavioral measures. So we'll stop focusing all of our measure on the outcomes or the activities, focus on the behaviors, the lead measures, as well as the outcomes. So the final thing is, and this is the bit that I think makes the huge difference, we also want to talk about the consequences of working like this. If we work well in this manner, what would we expect to happen in our relationship or in our the volume of business we get, whatever it is? But equally, if we don't do this stuff, if we don't act like this, or we break our commitments, what should be the natural consequence between our two organizations? And this sounds such a simple question, but when you get people to think about consequences of either success or failure, accountability becomes a lot clearer.
And have you been in situations where people haven't honoured those conditions? And how have you managed that?
Sadly, yes. And you have to have some governance processes in the accountabilities. You'll build a set of governance processes which are appropriate to the size of the project and the size of the relationship. And you'll take it through the governance process. But ultimately, if you've described the project and the consequences properly within the relationship, people get called out and the consequences are acted on. What breaks this thing down is if the consequences don't happen. And that's my experience in so many nice agreements, traditional transactional agreements. There may be consequences, but people are frightened that it will damage the relationship if the consequences are acted on. And that's a disaster in my view.
In most cases, it sounds as if the relationship between both parties is an equal relationship. Generally speaking, it's the buyer that tends to have the power in those relationships. That I'm assuming in the circumstances you're working in, that's not traditionally the case.
Well, where we're trying to get to is this is a peer-based relationship. Both because we're describing an outcome or a vision which is greater than either party could achieve on their own, or greater than they believe they could achieve under the old transactional process, it becomes a peer-based relationship. But that allows us to be more ambitious because we're no longer frightened that somebody's going to try and grab something for nothing, or they're going to try and slam my margin, or they're going to try and extend the scope without paying for it. All the old traditional fun things that go on in transactional world, professional services, IT, civil engineering, all of that stuff can stop because we can say, look, let's be really ambitious about what we're trying to achieve together, what we'll contribute to achieve that together. But the outcomes will be so significant, we can stop all the fighting. And the last thing about that is that if we have an ambitious target together, a vision together, and we do all the right things, but we don't, even by doing all the right things that we agree to, we still don't achieve the ultimate ambition. The likelihood is still, and my experience is still, that we achieve more than we would have done under the old model. And our people feel better about it, which takes us all the way back to something that Jeremy raised earlier.
So that sounds really interesting. So my experience also is that when organizations, these sort of agreements are great. When the organization comes under real pressure, that's when things start to become interesting. Have you had those sort of experiences, and how do you ensure that the agreements stay in place when the organization is really stressed or the project is really stressed?
And we're talking about really stressed now, aren't we? One of the things, and it is, there are, one can see how many businesses are looking at, businesses that previously would describe themselves as purpose-led and clear on their values and all the rest of it, how under the current pressure, all that's gone out the window and all of a sudden it's keep the cash. I mean, I saw a great example of a consultant to lawyers saying the only thing you need to do now is to get the cash in. Stop partners drawing expenses, tell them their drawings are going to be reduced if they're trying to retire, tell them they're not going to get their money, everything. It was a cash crisis management. And all of a sudden people are being told you're on 40% hours and 40% money, and it's being done by email. Where was the purpose in that? And one of the things that we're clear on is there are consequences to the behaviours that you take right now. And we're working with a couple of organisations who are saying, we have to make tough decisions, but the way we'll do that is to engage our team, and our suppliers and our clients in a sense of how do we work this together such that when the COVID crisis is over, we all come out of this whole and stronger. And that to me seems very different. I'll give you a specific example. I was talking to a director at Cisco's yesterday, and the CEO at Cisco has said, nobody will lose their job and we will pay you through this crisis. Now you might say, good for them, they've got lots of money. But I just, what a great narrative that is for when they try and get going again. Morrison's, who said, we are changing our rules. We will now pay all small suppliers immediately on presentation of an invoice. And by the way, we've changed the definition of small supplier from somebody who does 100,000 a month to somebody who does 1 million a month. Now, I think those organizations are thinking about their relationships with their staff and their suppliers and their clients in a completely different way and will benefit.
That is really interesting, isn't it? And you're right about the staff, because I believe it was yesterday they announced that Morrison's was also effectively giving their staff a one-off cash payment just to see them through if they're finding things difficult within their family. It's interesting to hear, in this kind of environment, it seems to be very polarizing, doesn't it? So that when perhaps players previously might not have been so clearly differentiated on purpose and value and the way that they behave, are they a good corporate citizen? Are they not a good corporate citizen? But times of crisis really define us, don't they?
Yeah, I think that's so good, so true. We recently ran a session, my colleague Stuart Maester and I, and we were lucky enough to have Philip King come on on a chat with us. And Philip is the small business ombudsman for the government. And he was terribly clear that if you want to survive as a small business, you need to move from transactional to collaborative relationship. And that will be the future, in his view, of successful small business. And I find that very refreshing.
But I think a lot of small businesses are currently being thrown under the bus. I mean, I've had a number of friends of mine who are consultants where they're working for very large organizations, but their retainers and things are just being cut instantly. There's no attempt to recognize that they've also got their problems. So, and that's quite surprising, bearing in mind that they're operating within consultancy already. But the other thing is about core values is that I'm interested that your starting point seems to be the sort of relationships with clients where I come out of a corporate identity type of consultancy basis, where we start with the whole organization as opposed to one part of an organization and establish the values there that then sort of filter down to the rest of the organization. So everybody starts behaving in a consistent way. It's interesting that you're focused on an area of the business and it sort of backs into the rest of the organization, from what I understand. And that's interesting because in order to get the consistency, I mean, you have situations where you suddenly have an organization operating out of character. For example, Volkswagen suddenly have all this problem with emissions where they're lying about emissions in order, I assume, to meet sales targets. So those people aren't operating on their own. They're operating because the culture of the organization is sort of driving them to that sort of behavior. And similarly, you might have a sales team or a group operating on a particular project who want to behave in a particular way, but then there are outside influences of which they have very little control, which start to interfere with it. How are you able to address those sort of influences, the things that aren't in the room? For example, you've got shareholders, and the shareholders might be putting pressure on the organization to make more profit. So that conversation is clearly having an impact somewhere. How do you factor that into the whole relationship?
Let me just pick up the first part of what you say, which I found interesting. What I guess where we come from is that clients are serving companies are serving markets, and they, I think we talked about earlier, they're not listening sufficiently to what those markets are saying they need. So that, I guess, is why we start with this emphasis on who are the most important markets, what are the values, what's the value you can create in that market. What we're trying to do is to stop organizations trying to be everything to everybody and recognizing that there's a lot of value in relationships which is untapped. Many people will tell you that 80% of their profit comes from 20% of their clients. Well, we think that that's a terrible waste of relationship capital. So we're saying, yes, that's the start point. But then relationship isn't between the sales force and that and the client. Relationship is every single individual in a business and how it behaves every time I touch them. So to go to the earlier example, if I ring the finance department, I want the same values and behaviors and intent towards the client as I would get from a salesperson. The relationship must not sit within individuals, as we have previously done. You know, we have paid major account sales guys huge amounts of money because we were frightened that without them we'd lose the relationship. What we're suggesting is relationships are holistic between organizations, and actually the best relationships are when they come together with a shared ambition. So I hope that makes sense as to why I was focusing on client relationship, but I don't want to do it through salespeople. They have a role, but they're not unique. Then the second point about external factors weighing in my experience of this is that people know this stuff, but they're so driven by short-term goals and numbers and transactional thinking that they allow it to impinge on their better behavior. Now, given what we were talking about earlier, if I'm working with a client in a major project environment or important projects, and I see the real impact, i.e. the consequences of doing something which would damage that relationship, not perhaps this week, but would damage it over a matter of weeks or months as these things come out. It's going to cause me, I hope, to really have pause to think it's not about what's on this quarter's profit and loss. It's a bigger picture than that. And that's cultural, has to come from the board. One of the big problems we've had with some of our engineering clients is they're saying, we have to report quarterly, so we chase the number. But actually in chasing the number, and again, I'm linking back to something I said, the biggest budget that they had was in litigation to try and get their money in. And you think to yourself, okay, if I could take away the litigation costs and give you that back, since that's your biggest budget, by changing the way you engage your clients, then I can avoid all this short-term thinking and all the short-term damage that you're doing to relationships by these kind of activities. So, I mean, look at the damage Volkswagen's done to itself with its behavior. How many people stop trusting?
Building up that reputation, just lost. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
There's no right, I wish I could say, and that will always work, Jeremy. It won't. But what we need to do is to keep rewarding and supporting the Morrisons of this world and others who are doing the right thing. And we need to keep using them as symbols of the value of doing the right thing. Because I hope Morrisons comes out of this really strongly.
But so you strongly believe that you can change the culture of a mature, large, well-established business?
Yes. Now, and that's a short answer, but it's a non-trivial activity. I had the good fortune to work with EY for 6 years on a change program that I think substantially moved the organization from focusing on transacting around an area of technical expertise to building broad relationships and making the organization substantially more successful. That was an organization of 20,000 people, 6 years of effort, and it's still ongoing and it will continue. So this is not give me a 2-week project, but then change of that level doesn't happen in 2 weeks.
It's interesting. So can you talk a little bit more about the EY experience? I'd be very interested to know what values which of the values actually changed and how you measured them. Because for me, I mean, I've been involved in a number of these programs where after the event, people put together case studies and they demonstrate X, Y, and Z. You go back there 5 years later and nothing's changed. I mean, I've worked for big banks, for example, where they talk about relationship management and they go through these processes to try and change the culture of the organization to really into a sort of client relationship sort of model. And they fail miserably because the stronger values, the DNA of the organization is not that. And it's not affected by some of these sort of more superficial programs. So even when there's a real intention to change, the culture of the organization is so strong and so resistant that they're not able to do it. If you're in a small organization or a startup, or you have some sort of charismatic leader who can drive these things through, then fine. But I've seen a lot of case histories where people claim to have succeeded in shifting a culture from A to B, but actually they haven't really, in my view.
Fair challenge. The steps that it's not just EY, but others are trying to go through. The steps are, how do you get engagement? And spend a lot of time with the organization working out what is fundamentally got to change and why, and who believes that, and what personal commitment are they making to that. And that in itself, that's that first phase I said to you, what's this worth? Why are we doing it? What's it worth? And what's it worth to the individuals? Because the leader, it may be a charismatic leader, but I know very few charismatic leaders of organizations, of partnerships, who can stand up and drive change unless the rest of the partners buy into it. So that's the first step, is really working with groups who could see it and wanted to do it. And once we'd got a reason to change, then we looked at what's the gap that they could see to achieving that change. Then we filled the gap with a new mindset. And that mindset was, what do your clients want? And we did a lot of client research, by the way, about what do clients want from the very best in professional services. And then we built that into a mindset change. We gave them new skills of how you talk to people and how you build relationships. We gave them tools to support that. And then we built a cultural change support program, which included having, I think before I left, there was something like 220 partners and senior directors who had gone through a coaching qualification that we built. And the coaching qualification was on driving and supporting the cultural change that we set out to do. Having set out some measures at the front, we then collected and reported on measures, behavioral change, and success stories of behavioral change, client success stories, and kept reporting on those. And we created a viral environment where more and more parts of the business came to my team and said, we need to do this. And finally, having started at the senior levels of the organization, we then engaged the rest of the business. And the most successful thing we did was to train relatively junior people on how to build relationships when you're in delivery. And from there, it went to, we trained grads when they came in that your job is not to learn to become a great accountant. Your job is to learn to become a great relationship manager, whatever your role is going to be. So we took it through the whole organization. So by the time I left, every single person was getting exposure to relationships is what it's about. Relationships is what's going to make you successful. We're going to measure your ability to create relationships. We're going to support you in blah, blah, blah. Everything became about the one story.
But to a degree with values, do you not think that they start with personal self-awareness? And if you have a set of values that are personally that are aligned with the organization that you're working with, that's when it works. But trying to instill values into somebody where those values aren't inherent is very difficult.
Yeah, so a firm like EY or PwC or anything will be trying to recruit towards a set of values which are consistent. What we had to do was make sure that they were reinforced with behaviors that were consistent. So we set expectations on people of how those values would translate into action and build relationships. And we undoubtedly lost people, right? I mean, did everybody we started with come on the journey? No. We said to people, though, here's the, you know, using Jim Collins' idea, here's the bus. Here's where the bus is going to go. There are seats on the bus for you. However, if you get on the bus, we will be measuring how well you align yourselves to the expected values and behaviors. So there are accountabilities. If you get on the bus and you take a seat, you will be accountable. And if you don't do the things you say you're going to do, there are consequences. Well, one of the consequences, you're going to feel damn uncomfortable here and you might leave. But another is getting the numbers the wrong way is not success for our business and you won't get promoted. You won't get that partner role. And then we assess people all the way through on that kind of thing. So you won't get everybody.
So I'm going to say, are there intergenerational, cultural, gender differences? Do younger people adapt to this more quickly than older people? Are they more open to this sort of thinking? Is there any evidence of these differences?
I wish I could say I had evidence other than just standing up in front of people. We started, and I've done this before, we started with the most senior, successful people. My experience of that, this is in IT and everywhere, is the most experienced and successful people have nothing to fear. Most of them see any ideas like this as a potential change. So if you can help me be even more successful, thanks very much. And once you've got that group of people who are admired by the organization and who are willing to not only participate but lead change, then it becomes much easier. The bit that I didn't find so easy was the middle rank, funnily enough. Juniors, new young people, the young folks that we brought in, listen to me, the old man, but the young grads that we brought in, when you said to them, hell, do you like having friends? Yes, I do. Do you like building a relationship with those friends? Yes, I do. Great. Could we encourage you to do that with people you meet in business? Yeah, sure, no problem. It was the middle manager, the middle layer, who kind of aspired to be just an expert in something and to keep doing their expertise. They were the people that we struggled with most.
Quite fascinating to me, because if you think about the 80s and 90s and you think about the string of recessions as we now know them, that have led us to here, it often seemed to be the middle management that were being sliced out when organizations were struggling. And, you know, people talk a lot about how somebody becomes very good at what they do vocationally. And because they are the person in the role, they float into a team lead role. And because they're still there, they float into a middle management role. And that actually they might just have wanted to stay as a vocational lead. And that perhaps the middle managers are the ones that need the most help. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, it absolutely is. I mean, if you look at law firms, big accounting firms, most of them will bring people in to be a lawyer or to be a litigator or to be a tax expert, right? And you'll work alongside partners doing that stuff as a junior. And you'll be told that if you're good at doing that, you'll get promoted. So you get really good at your technical expertise, you get promoted. And that's the way that most professional services firms have worked, okay? And then in the case of one of the big four, at the point you get the top job title senior manager, you're suddenly told your job is to build relationships and sell. And at that point, a huge proportion of them throw their hands in the air and go and get jobs as finance directors or as company secretaries or whatever. They exit the profession in huge numbers at that point. And it's because we've built one sort of skill set in them and then suddenly told them they got a different job. And they are horrified at the idea that they now have to go out and, worse than that, they're told you're supposed to go out and sell. And if you want to really upset people in professional services firms at that level, tell them they're salespeople.
Resolve that in the organizations you've worked with, because ultimately, as I understand it, if you hear somebody talking about professional services business X or Y, they will say it's all about the billable hours. They're always on the clock.
Yeah. Utilization is a big measure for people. However, you can find people that say, well, utilization is really good, but importantly, my income per hour is really good. And why is that? Because the kind of work I'm doing is with clients who value me highly, and therefore I can claim that value back in terms of the fees I charge. So, you know, what the firm's really interested in is contribution margin. And there's two ways you do it. You contribute by doing 100% of your hours, or you contribute by doing a lesser number but at a higher rate per hour. And if you think about quality from the client's point of view, they want the latter. The individual wants the latter. But in absence of good relationships, the only thing they could drive was more hours in transactional relationships.
Interesting about this, Jeremy, is that professional services firms are said to be the largest service firms in the world. And if the largest, who also stand to gain the most from an incremental improvement, are starting to realize these things and starting to focus on them and presumably seeing some significant benefits from them, then I feel like all of the smaller businesses could really learn from that.
I think they've got huge challenges going forward as well with the development of AI and all this sort of stuff, where they're going to have to focus much, much more on adding value through relationships and things. So they've got a huge amount to gain from this sort of thinking. But just changing slightly, I mean, Dominic Cummins model, Kevin, where he throws a hand grenade into an organization in order to change the culture, you know, change behavior, change attitudes. What's your view on his approach?
Jeremy, I really don't know enough about his style. I mean, one reads, but my belief will be that the experience that you have of it from the inside is probably very different to what we read about. And I remember a very good analogy. Who was it? He was the ex-ICI chairman. He used to do a program on the BBC. He came and spoke at my company one time. And he was saying friction is a good thing. It's about getting the right amount of friction. Think of your business like a car. If it's on ice and there's no friction under the tires, you go nowhere. If, however, under the tires of your car, you've got so much friction, it can't overcome it, you go nowhere. So the point in business is to have enough friction that you can really get traction. And I like that idea. And I don't know Dominic Cummings, but it seems to me that there have been, in the absence, and I keep coming back to the same theme, in the absence of clarity about who we are, the value we create, and how we do it in the market, so often the loudest voice has gained action. And I think he may just be used to shouting loudly because he doesn't see anybody who understands where he's trying to go, so he just shouts at them. I don't know, but it's an interesting idea.
But it's not just that, because he's also bringing people who are completely atypical of the other people in the organization. So he's bringing, I mean, he describes them as weirdos, but essentially what he's saying is that he's bringing in people that essentially are going to upset the status quo, who think differently, who act differently, as a model for showing people within the organization that there are different ways of doing things. So rather than necessarily the softly, softly training route, he's sort of taking a more overt, more aggressive route, which I suspect he thinks will happen more quickly.
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting. I was fortunate enough to know Stephen Covey well, who wrote The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And he said something which may be relevant. And he said this: if you've got two people in the team who think the same way, one of them's redundant. And so you need, in his view, you need to have divergent thinking in the room in order to create the greatest synergies. But you also need to have the ability in those people to step back and say, this is not a personal attack. This is just somebody who thinks differently to me. Let me listen to that individual and understand what they know. And then perhaps when I understand it deeply, what they know plus what I know, we could come out with a third alternative. And Stephen wrote that book called The Third Alternative, which is better than either of us could have conceived. But that may be a really difficult thing for civil servants to get their heads around, that divergent thinking is actually good thinking.
But also you've got a selection process that very often screens those people out of the recruitment process at the beginning. They don't get through to joining these sort of organisations. Would that be a fair comment?
As far as I'm aware, yeah. I mean, it's you know, those characteristics, it's the man from Whitehall. But hopefully that was why they used to bring political advisors in the first place, wasn't it? To get a different perspective. And maybe Dominic Cummings is just pursuing that. And I'd love to know him and to work inside the room, as it were, more, because I'd like to see this in action. Does he create divergent thinking, but does he then cause people to do it without resentment? If he's creating huge resentment, then he won't get the best from people, will he?
My sense is there's a lot of fear in there, which is never a good thing in my view. But what I'm also interested in this whole, and you're talking about professional firms and so on, and my sense is that very often people go into those organisations, they tend to stay for a number of years. I came out of advertising agencies originally, and they used to say all the best people are just moving through. And if you stayed more than 2 years in an ad agency, you were there too long. And I get that sense in a lot of IT businesses, in a lot of marketing and creative businesses. How does the notion of mutual value operate there, where you haven't really got that. You can build a level of trust, you can build a level of relationship, but with the turnover that you have of your really good people, it's very difficult to maintain.
Yeah, to me, it goes to understanding the effort you need to make, A, in the recruitment process. So I don't want just people who think the same way, but I do want people who have similar values coming into an organization. How you recruit, and then how you exit those people. Because one of the things I think we all need to recognize is the strength of maintaining relationships with people who have created value for your organization. So recruitment, support, development, continual effort to help those people become clear about the value we're trying to create, to get them excited. I think that one of the reflections I have is that people don't stay because they're just not motivated, they're not engaged, they don't feel they have voice, and they don't understand how they're making a contribution. Now, we shouldn't want to, and we won't stop people moving on. They need to move on in some cases to develop. But they shouldn't move on simply because they don't have voice and they don't understand how they're contributing, or they don't value what their organization is doing. So I think we can change some of the perspectives of that.
I saw a statistic that suggested that 80% of people hate their job. I mean, in that sort of environment, it suggests that you've got a huge opportunity, you've got a huge market out there to sort of to work with, because we seem to be not very good at creating organizations people want to work in.
Interesting. One of the things that we're mapping with, and so as I use professional services, but we're also working with IT services firms, we're working with civil engineering, we're working with some big mostly B2B businesses, but large businesses. And we've started to map where they make their profit. And then we cross-reference that with the satisfaction, their employee satisfaction. And here's a shocking finding that you would never guess, that in those organizations, those teams where you have the lowest employee engagement, you have the lowest margin. And yet, companies continue to persist with whole ranges of clients who are making them little or no money. If you thought of the cost, one of the reasons they do that is they don't look at the cost of it to them of staff turnover and things like that. If they once looked at the holistic cost of having a bad client, in terms of the way it upsets your employees and the impact that has on quality, staff turnover, retraining costs, et cetera, they would make significant changes in the number of clients they work with.
Just changing the subject for a while, the current coronavirus emergency, how do you think that's going to affect the ways in which organizations operate? And the relationship thing. I mean, how do you see all that panning out? Do you see it?
Well, again, so there's a number of thoughts on that. The first is the way you react to the coronavirus as a business is telling a story and creating a narrative that will live in the market after the coronavirus is over. So we're trying to encourage people to think very carefully how they deal with clients, how they deal with customers, how they deal with, their employees and suppliers, and to map right now again, where do you want to be working? Given what we're just saying, maybe this is the time to sit back and say, I'm going to really apply some different values to who I choose to work with in the market. I'm going to really apply different value to who are my suppliers. And so that's the first thing. The second thing is that we're already seeing clients saying, okay, we've done the crisis management, we've looked at the cash flow, we've looked at balance sheets, we have to start planning. And maybe now is a really, really good time to refocus our business, because we know there's going to be less clients to deal with, there's going to be less, potentially less opportunity. So we can't just assume the new normal is going to be the same as the old normal. And so maybe this is the time to become less transactional, more partnering. And so that's moved. So we're seeing two things. One, people are already moving out of crisis into planning. And two, there's a view to moving away from transaction to collaboration. So I think this is going to be a tipping point. I think this is going to accelerate enormously people's interest in partnership. And that could be a good thing that comes out of it. Or we could go back to the old transactional way of doing things. And I think that we really risk a breakdown in our commercial operations. I don't think the consumers want to see that happen.
Do you think about this move towards home working and so on? Because one of the things that I was reading was that it seems to be reinforcing relationships, individual relationships between clients and the account manager and so on. So it's becoming a much more personal, much more relationship orientated, simply because they're having to relate on this sort of one-to-one basis through the internet, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. And you know, there's lots of individuals who are proving to be very good at reaching out to other individuals. And of course, one wants to encourage that. But from our definition of relationship, there's a risk, inherent risk, if you just have one-on-one. What we believe needs to happen is organizations moving out to building relationships which are much more important with other organizations, but are also holistic and not dependent on individuals. Now, I think that the other thing on the personal level, I think this has to be time limited. We all have to think we're going to come out of this, because I'm sure I'm not the only one. I miss meeting people face to face.
Understand that. Well, one thing that really crosses my mind when you're talking is, by far, the majority of people are employed in small businesses or are self-employed. Having learned what you've learned about mutual benefit, and having us just heard how that can be applied in an organizational context, what would be your advice to somebody who's self-employed or somebody who runs a small business or is part of a small business, and how to respond to this moment and what's going to come next when we do emerge from our caves?
Yeah, I can only give you, as a small business ourselves, and you know, this has come as a very interesting time for us. We set our business up 9 or 10 months ago, having worked out the ideas and built all the sort of programs and all this, and we had just started on a number of major projects with clients, and then bang, lockdown. And my advice to small businesses is, if you're thinking this is the good time to think about, you know, what value, who are you, what do you want to do? Same thing that we would say to big businesses: what is it that you bring to the market? And then, and we've done this next step, and you know, partly that's why I'm on this call, is then to look out and say, who else could I work with collaboratively, who, if we joined up and we brought our ideas together to market, we could be even more powerful? And that's what we've been doing. We've built a number of our own. We're building an ecosystem around us of people who think like us, who value the kind of ideas that we're, and we value their ideas. I mentioned one of them, the Big Ears folks, CNS. These are people who have skills and services that I wouldn't know how to get into, but I know that I'm talking to clients who would value them. So I'm saying that for small businesses, building ecosystems and networks could be A, easier and faster, and B, an even better way to get into market than they're currently trying to. So I think it's about building not networks, not where we all know each other, but ecosystems where we have a shared vision of how we could create something new and better in the market. So I think it's a great opportunity for small businesses at the moment.
And you think that your techniques are equally transferable into small organizations as they are with the very large ones?
Yeah, well, I, Yes, I do. The reason we're into all the big businesses is because the trigger point was the sort of thing I talked about before. They were all doing large RFP-based projects, and then they had large operational delivery teams, and there were all sorts of misalignments, and very happy to talk to businesses of all sizes. You can find our website with some ideas and tools and materials you can look at. That's www.mutual-value.com. I'm available on kevinvs@mutual-value.com. And you'll find our phone number or my colleague Stuart Maister's contact details up there as well. So look forward to any conversations people want to have.
Very good. Listen, thanks ever so much, Kevin. That was really helpful. Very interesting.
Fascinating. And all the best building the ecosystems and going to market and creating systems of mutual.
And guys, thank you. Thank you for putting up with the technical challenges I created. And the opportunity to have an interesting conversation. I look forward to hearing it.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Cheerio. Thanks for tuning in, folks. That's another episode of Old Fox, Young Fox Under the Belt. Hope you've enjoyed it as much as we have delivering it. Hope you are safe and well and being responsible and looking after yourselves. You can follow the show and get in touch and tell us what you think on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And you can support the show on Patreon. Head over to donate.oldfoxyoungfox.com. All donations are used to make this show better. And we'll see you next time. Oh,